Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, looking at the issue of the cost of U.S. nuclear forces. What put this on your radar screen in the first place? It's gotten a fair amount of attention all across the defense budget spectrum in the last several years, but what was it that jumped out at you as something that needed attention, Todd?
Well, I think it needed attention because there are so many different cost estimates that were really all over the map in terms of the time period they were covering, what types of forces they were including, and the total dollar amount that they came to. So we wanted to do this to really kind of clear the air on the issue and come out with a detailed bottom-up estimate of the cost of nuclear forces and be very transparent about our methodology. So if people want to question how we allocated certain costs, they'll have the data there. They could recalculate it using their own assumption if they want to.
This has been of interest to not just people like us who observe what's going on in the defense budget business, but obviously it's of great interest to the companies that are potentially involved with this in the defense industrial base. And Congress looking at this, most recently the Government Accountability Office reporting to Congress about this issue, and we have a link to their report at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. What did you see when you looked at the GAO's work on this?
Well, the GAO, what they basically did is went in and audited DOD and Department of Energy budget estimates for what they say nuclear forces are going to cost over the next 10 years. So when I looked at that, now we did our estimate out farther into the future. We went 25 years out. But since, you know, the 10 years that they're looking at was covered within our estimate, I went and compared it to what we did. The thing that stands out most, though, is that when DOD cites the cost of nuclear forces and nuclear modernization, they're including the full cost of bombers, of the B-52s, the B-2s, and the next generation bomber, LRS-B. They're including the full cost of those platforms as being nuclear related, but those are dual use systems. And in fact, you know, they're mostly used for conventional missions. If you take the B-52, for example, we keep one squadron assigned for nuclear mission at any given time. The other three squadrons, three quarters of them, are not assigned to the nuclear mission at any given point in time. So, you know, why count 100% of those costs when that's not 100% of what they do? That actually is one of the biggest factors that comes out in our study, is it makes a big difference how you allocate costs for dual-use systems.
You and your colleague, Evan Braden Montgomery, are releasing this report on Tuesday, and we have details about the event at which it will come out at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. You write in this preview that you've sent over, our analysis concludes U.S. nuclear forces are affordable because their projected costs account for a small percentage of the overall defense budget, and you discuss the expand on the reasons for that. It strikes me that that percentage maybe is the most important number in all the material that you've put out so far, because you're allowing for 95% to 97% of the rest of the budget for the rest of the strategic goals that we want to achieve.
Yeah, so that's the, you know, it's probably going to be the big takeaway of the whole report, is that if you look at the cost of the nuclear-related cost for all of our nuclear forces, this includes all the delivery vehicles, munitions, command and control systems, and the warheads themselves that are primarily funded out of the Department of Energy. If you add all that together, at its peak, it only comes to 5% of the total national defense budget. So when people try to make the argument that, you know, nuclear forces and the modernization programs are unaffordable, you know, I call foul on that. How can 5% be unaffordable? Now, there is a good point, though, that peak in the modernization of nuclear forces, when we get up to 5% of the budget being dedicated to it, that occurs at the same time that a lot of our conventional forces modernization programs are going to be peaking as well. Things like the Joint Strike Fighter, for example, the tanker, the Air Force's trainer, all kinds of shipbuilding programs. And so in totality, when you take all the modernization programs together that are all going to be peaking around the middle of the next decade, that does become a problem. But can you single out nuclear forces and say that that's what makes it unaffordable? I don't think that's fair. It's 5% of the budget.
Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And what you're really getting at there, Todd, is the overall debate that we've all watched take form over the last, probably 2 to 5 years over how you establish priorities and how you try to comport strategy with budget and mission with budget and figure it all out together simultaneously rather than doing it all one way and then not being able to pay for all the capability you want, or doing it the other way and having to strike things off just because you don't have the money.
Right. And that really is the takeaway from all of this, is it's not a matter of affordability. It's a matter of prioritization. How do nuclear forces fit within your strategy, and what priority do you afford your nuclear forces? That's what really matters here. And people can come to different conclusions about that, have different opinions, but really that's what it boils down to, is are you going to make nuclear forces and their modernization programs a priority? If so, yes, you've got the money to fund it. The other thing that comes out of this too is I say that nuclear forces are going to grow to about 5% of the budget. They're about 3% of the budget today, so it's an increase of 2%. The other way you could fund this without cutting anything is to increase the defense budget by 2%. That's not much of an increase at all, actually. Within a decade, we have seen in the past fluctuations in the budget level of up to 50%. So the fact that we just need an extra 2% of funding out in the middle of the next decade, that's not a far stretch to think that we might get 2% more funding by then.
It's not a big increase in terms of percentages, but the dollars, when you add the dollars up, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, we're talking, around $12 billion increase in the annual defense budget on a budget that's already $500 billion. It's a fair point. If you're going to increase the funding, it's got to come from somewhere, if not within the DOD budget, within the rest of the federal budget, or from increased revenues, or just running a higher deficit in those years. I don't want to minimize it, how challenging this could be, but the real point, again, is that nuclear forces on their own are not what's unaffordable. It's the entire modernization bow wave of conventional forces with nuclear forces is what's going to be a problem in the next decade.
Yeah, I agree with you that that's point one, and I might argue that point 1A is the prioritization thing that you and I have talked about, is determining exactly what the priority of our nuclear force structure is in terms of what we want to achieve strategically and globally, and then figuring out what the right amount of money is to make that happen relative to all the other priorities that are going. I'm afraid I just still don't quite see that happening, Todd. I don't mean that cynically.
But with all the budget uncertainty that we've had, since 2011, since the Budget Control Act was enacted, there's just been so much turmoil that, the department really hasn't, quite frankly, had the time or the clarity of future funding levels to sit down and develop a strategy that can be executed within realistic budget constraints that Congress is placing on it. That's still something that needs to be done, and that's where you would begin in order to come up with that prioritization to say, okay, well, what's really important here, and what are we going to fund? The other thing I would point out, and part of what's going to be in the study that we release on Tuesday, is that it's not that you wouldn't do anything to change nuclear forces or to change the modernization programs. There actually are a number of things you could do that would help smooth out that bow wave so that you don't peak at quite as high of a level. There are program changes you could make, and we explore some of those options in the paper. They're not going to save you tons of money or anything like that, but it could help smooth that modernization bow wave and make it a little easier to get through.
Would that require some coordination and cooperation on the parts of the branches, or is that something that could be managed sufficiently at the OSD level that it could really be one group in charge of it?
Most of them would require some coordination between DOD and DOE to align the modernization programs for platforms and warheads. So there would have to be some coordination there, but they're already pretty good at coordinating those efforts. So I don't think that's too far of a stretch that they could do that.
Congratulations to you and Evan on completing this work. I look forward to the event on Tuesday, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing people there.